I do not know who you are, Taran said bitterly. I do know that a brave man has bought your life for you. I am Fluda Flam, son of Godo, the stranger said, bowing deeply, a bard of the harp at your service. I have no need of bards, Taran said. A harp will not bring my companion to life. Lord Gwydion is dead? Fluda Flam asked. Those are sorrowful tidings. He is a kinsman, and I owe allegiance to the House of Don. But why do you blame his death on me? If Gwydion has bought my life, at least tell me how, and I shall mourn with you. Go your way, said Taran. It is no fault of yours. I trusted Gwydion's life to a traitor and liar. My own life should be forfeit. Those are hard words to apply to a winsome lass, said the bard, especially one who isn't here to defend herself. I want no explanation from her, he said. There is nothing she can tell me. She can lose herself in the forest for all I care. If she's as much of a traitor and a liar as you say, Fluda remarked, then you're letting her off easily. You may not want her explanation, but I'm quite sure Gwydion would. Allow me to suggest you go and find her before she strays too far. Taran nodded. Yes, he said coldly. Gwydion shall have justice. He turned on his heel and walked toward the trees. Ailanwy had gone no great distance. He could see the glow of the sphere a few paces ahead, where the girl sat on a boulder in a clearing. She looked small and thin. Her head was pressed into her hands, and her shoulders shook.
"Now you've made me cry," she burst out as Taran approached. "I hate crying. It makes my nose feel like a melted icicle. You've hurt my feelings, you stupid assistant pig-keeper, and all for something that's your own fault to begin with."
Taran was so taken aback that he began to stammer.
"Yes," cried Ailanwy. "It's every bit your fault. You were so close-mouthed about the man you wanted me to rescue, and you kept talking about your friend in the other cell. Very well, I rescued whoever it was in the other cell."
"You didn't tell me there was anyone else in the dungeon."
"There wasn't," Ailanwy insisted. "Fluda Flam, or whatever he calls himself, was the only one."
"Then where is my companion?" Taran demanded. "Where is Gwydion?"
"I don't know," Ailanwy said. "He wasn't in Akron's dungeon, that's sure. What's more, he never was."
Taran realized the girl was speaking the truth. As his memory returned, he recalled that Gwydion had been with him only briefly. He had not seen the guards put him in a cell. Taran had only guessed at that.
What could she have done with him?
"I haven't any idea in the world," Ailanwy said and sniffed. "She could have brought him to her chambers, or locked him in the tower. There's a dozen places she could have hidden him. All you needed to say was, go and rescue a man named Gwydion, and I would have found him. But no, you had to be so clever about it and keep everything to yourself."
Taran's heart sank.
"I must go back to the castle and find him. Will you show me where Akron might have imprisoned him?" "There's nothing left of the castle," said Ailanwy. "Besides, I'm not sure I'm going to help you any more at all, after the way you've behaved. And calling me those horrid names, that's like putting caterpillars in somebody's hair."
She tossed her head, put her chin in the air, and refused to look at him. "I accused you falsely," Taran said. "My shame is as deep as my sorrow." Ailanwy, without lowering her chin, gave him a sidelong glance.
"I should think it would be."
"I shall seek him alone," said Taran. "You are right in refusing to help. It is no concern of yours." He turned and started out of the clearing.
"Well, you don't have to agree with me so quickly," Ailanwy cried.
She slid off the boulder and hastened after him. Fluda Flam was still waiting when they returned. In the light of Ailanwy's sphere, Taran had a better view of this unexpected arrival. The bard was tall and lanky, with a long, pointed nose. His great shock of bright yellow hair burst out in all directions like a ragged sun. His jacket and leggings were patched at knees and elbows, and sewn with large, clumsy stitches, the work, Taran was certain, of the bard himself. A harp with a beautiful, sweeping curve was slung from his shoulder, but otherwise he looked nothing at all like the bards Taran had learned about from the Book of Three.
"So it seems that I've been rescued by mistake," Fluda said, after Taran explained what had happened. "I should have known it would turn out to be something like that. I kept asking myself, crawling along those beastly tunnels, who could possibly be interested whether I was languishing in a dungeon or not?"
"I'm going back to the castle," Taran said. "There may be hope that Gwydion still lives."
"By all means," cried the bard, his eyes lighting up. "A flam to the rescue. Storm the castle. Carry it by assault. Batter down the gates."
"There's not much of it left to storm," said Ailanwy.
"Oh," said Fluda, with disappointment. "Very well. We shall do the best we can."
At the summit of the hill, the mighty blocks of stone lay as if crushed by a giant fist. Only the square arch of the gate remained upright, gaunt as a bone. In the moonlight, the ruins seemed already ancient. Shreds of mist hung over the shattered tower. Akron had learned of his escape, Taran guessed, for at the moment of the castle's destruction, she had sent out a company of guards. Amid the rubble, their bodies sprawled motionless as the stones. With growing despair, Taran climbed over the ruins. The foundations of the castle had collapsed. The walls had fallen inward. The bard and Ailanwy helped Taran try to shift one or two of the broken rocks, but the work was beyond their strength. At last, the exhausted Taran shook his head. "We can do no more," he murmured. "This shall stand as Gwydion's burial mound." He stood a moment, looking silently over the desolation, then turned away. Fluda suggested taking weapons from the bodies of the guards. He equipped himself with a dagger, sword, and spear. In addition to the blade she had taken from the barrow, Ailanwy carried a slim dagger at her waist. Taran collected as many bows and quivers of arrows as he could carry. The group was now lightly but effectively armed. With heavy hearts, the little band made their way down the slope. Melengar followed docilely, her head bowed, as if she understood that she would not see her master again. "I must leave this evil place," Taran cried. "I am impatient to be gone from here. Spiral Castle has brought me only grief. I have no wish to see it again."
"What has it brought the rest of us?" Ailanwy asked. "You make it sound as though we were just sitting around having a splendid time while you moan and take on."
Taran stopped abruptly. I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean it that way."
"Furthermore," said Ailanwy, "you're mistaken if you think I'm going to go marching through the woods in the middle of the night."
"And I," put in Fluda, "I don't mind telling you, I am so tired I could sleep on Akron's doorstep."
"We all need rest," Taran said, "but I don't trust Akron, alive or dead, and we still know nothing of the Cauldronborn. If they escaped, they may be looking for us right now. No matter how tired we are, it would be foolhardy to stay this close." Ailanwy and Fluda agreed to continue on for a little distance. After a time, they found a spot well protected by trees and flung themselves wearily to the turf. Taran unsaddled Melengar, thankful the girl had thought to bring along Gwydion's gear. He found a cloak in a saddlebag and handed it to Ailanwy. The bard wrapped himself in his own tattered garment and set his harp carefully on a gnarled root. Taran stood the first watch. Thoughts of the livid warriors still haunted him, and he saw their faces in every shadow. As the night wore on, the passage of a forest creature or the restless sighing of wind in the leaves made him start. The bushes rustled. This time it was not the wind. He heard a faint scratching, and his hand flew to his sword. A figure bounded into the moonlight and rolled up to Taran.
"Crunchings and munchings," whimpered a voice.
"Who is your peculiar friend?" asked the bard, sitting up and looking curiously at this new arrival. "For an assistant peacekeeper," remarked Ailanwy, "you do keep strange company. Where did you find it? And what is it? I've never seen anything like that in my life."
"He is no friend of mine," cried Taran. "He is a miserable, sneaking wretch who deserted us as soon as we were attacked."
"No, no,"
Gergi protested, whimpering and bobbing his matted head.
"Poor, humble Gergi is always faithful to mighty lords. What joy to serve them, even with shakings and breakings."
"Tell the truth," said Taran. "You ran off when we needed you most.
Slashings and gashings are for noble lords, not for poor, weak, Gurgi. Oh, fearsome whistlings of blades. Gurgi ran to look for help, mighty lord.
You didn't succeed in finding any, Taran said angrily.
Oh, sadness, Gurgi moaned. There was no help for brave warriors. Gurgi went far, far, with great squeakings and shriekings.
I'm sure you did, Taran said.
What else can unhappy Gurgi do? He is sorry to see great warriors in distress. Oh, tears of misery. But in battle, what would there be for poor Gurgi except hurtful guttings and cuttings of his throat?
It wasn't very brave, said Ailanmi, but it wasn't altogether stupid either. I don't see what advantage there was for him to be chopped up, especially if he wasn't any help to you in the first place.
Oh, wisdom of a noble lady, Gurgi cried, throwing himself at Ailanmi's feet. If Gurgi had not gone seeking help, he would not be here to serve you now. But he is here, yes, yes, faithful Gurgi returns to beatings and bruisings from the terrifying warrior.
Just keep out of my sight, Taran said, or you really will have something to complain about. Gurgi snuffled.
Gurgi hastens to obey, mighty lord. He will say no more, not even whisperings of what he saw. No, he will not disturb the sleepings of powerful heroes. See how he leaves with tearful farewells.
Come back here immediately, Taran called. Gurgi brightened.
Crunchings?
Listen to me, Taran said. There's hardly enough to go around, but I'll give you a fair share of what we have. After that, you'll have to find your own munchings. Gurgi nodded.
Many more hosts march in the valley with sharp spears. Oh, many more. Gurgi watches so quietly and cleverly, he does not ask them for help. No, they would only give harmful hurtings.
What's this? What's this? Cried Fluda. A great host? I should love to see them. I always enjoy processions and that sort of thing.
The enemies of the House of Dawn are gathering, Taran hurriedly told the bard. Gwydion and I saw them before we were captured. Now, if Gurgi speaks the truth, they have gathered reinforcements. The bard sprang to his feet.
A flam never shrinks from danger. The mightier the foe, the greater the glory. We shall seek them out, set upon them. The bards shall sing our praises forever.
Carried away by Fluda's enthusiasm, Taran seized his sword. Then he shook his head, remembering Gwydion's words in the forest near Caer Dalban. No. No, he said slowly. It would be folly to think of attacking them. He smiled quickly at Fluda. The bards would sing of us, he admitted, but we'd be in no position to appreciate it. Fluda sat down again, disappointed.
You can talk about the bards singing your praises all you want, said Ailanwy. I'm in no mood to do battle. I'm going to sleep.
With that, she curled up on the ground and pulled the cloak over her head. Still unconvinced, Fluda settled himself against a tree root for his turn at guard. Gurgi curled up at Ailanwy's feet. Exhausted though he was, Taran lay awake. In his mind, he saw again the horned king and heard the screams from the flaming cages. He sat up quickly. Grieving for his companion, he had forgotten what had brought him here. His own quest had been for Henwen, Gwydion's to warn the sons of Don. Taran's head spun. With his companion surely dead, should he now try to make his way to Caer Dathil? What then would become of Henwen? Everything had ceased to be simple. He yearned for the peacefulness of Caer Dalban, yearned even to weed the vegetable gardens and make horseshoes. He turned restlessly, finding no answer. At last his weariness overcame him, and he slept, plunged in nightmares. Chapter 10 The Sword Durnwin. It was full daylight when Taran opened his eyes. Gurgi was already sniffing hungrily at the saddlebags. Taran rose quickly and shared out as much of the remaining provisions as he dared, keeping a small amount in reserve, since he had no idea how difficult it would be to find food during the coming journey. In the course of the restless night, he had reached his decision, though at present he refrained from speaking of it, still unsure he had chosen wisely. For the moment, he concentrated on a meager breakfast. Gergi, sitting cross-legged, devoured his food with so many outcries of pleasure and loud smackings of his lips that he seemed to be eating twice as much as he really did. Fluda bolted his scant portion as though he had not enjoyed a meal for at least 5 days. Ilanwi was more interested in the sword she had taken from the barrow. It lay across her knees, and, with a perplexed frown, the tip of her tongue between her lips, the girl was studying the weapon curiously. As Taran grew near, Ilanwi snatched the sword away.
"Well," said Taran with a laugh, "you needn't act as if I were going to steal it from you."
Although jewels studded the hilt and pommel, the scabbard was battered, discolored, nearly black with age. For all that, it had an air of ancient lineage, and Taran was eager to hold it.
"Come," he said, "let me see the blade."
"I dare not," cried Ilanwi, to Taran's great surprise. He saw that her face was solemn and almost fearful.
"There is a symbol of power on the scabbard," Ilanwi continued. "I've seen this mark before, on some of Akron's things. It always means something forbidden. Of course, all Akron's things are like that, but some are more forbidden than others."
"There's another inscription, too," said Ilanwi, frowning again, "but it's in the old writing." She stamped a foot.
"Oh, I do wish Akron had finished teaching it to me. I can almost make it out, but not quite, and there's nothing more irritating. It's like not finishing what you started out to say."
Fluda came up just then, and he, too, peered at the strange weapon.
"Comes from a barrow, eh?"
The bard shook his spiky yellow head and whistled.
"I suggest getting rid of it immediately. Never had much confidence in things you find in barrows. It's a bad business having anything to do with them. You can't be sure where else they've been and who all's had them."
"If it's an enchanted weapon," Taran began, more interested than ever in getting his hands on the sword,
"shouldn't we keep it?" "Oh, do be quiet," Ilanwi cried. "I can't hear myself think. I don't see what you're both talking about, getting rid of it or not getting rid of it. After all, it's mine, isn't it? I found it and carried it out, and almost got stuck in a dirty old tunnel because of it."
"Bards are supposed to understand these things," Taran said.
"Naturally,"
Fluda answered, smiling confidently and putting his long nose closer to the scabbard.
"These inscriptions are all pretty much the same. I see this one's on the scabbard rather than the blade. It says, oh, something like, 'Beware my wrath.' The usual sentiments."
At that moment, there was a loud twang. Fluda blinked. One of his harp strings had snapped.
"Excuse me," he said, and went to see about his instrument.
"It doesn't say anything at all like that," Ilanwi declared. "I can read some of it now. Here, it starts near the hilt and goes winding around like ivy. I was looking at it the wrong way. It says Durnwin first. I don't know whether that's the name of the sword or the name of the king." "Oh, yes, that's the name of the sword. Here it is again. Draw Durnwin, only thou of royal blood, to rule, to strike the..."
"Something or other," Ilanwi went on.
"It's very faint. I can't see it. The letters are worn too smooth. No, that's odd. They aren't worn. They've been scratched out. They must have been cut deeply, because there's still a trace. But I can't read the rest. This word looks as if it might be death."
She shuddered.
"That's not very cheerful."
"Let me unsheath it," Taran urged again. "There might be more on the blade."
"Certainly not," said Ilanwi. "I told you it had a symbol of power, and I am bound by it. That's elementary."
"Akron cannot bind you any longer."
"It isn't Akron," Ilanwi answered. "I only said she had things with the same mark. This is a stronger enchantment than any she could make, I'm quite sure. I wouldn't dare to draw it, and I don't intend letting you either. Besides, it says only royal blood, and doesn't mention a word about assistant pig-keepers."
"How can you tell I haven't royal blood?" Taran asked, bristling. "I wasn't born an assistant pig-keeper. For all you know, my father might have been a king. It happens all the time in the Book of Three."
"I never heard of the Book of Three," said Ilanwi. "But in the first place, I don't think it's good enough to be a king's son, or even a king himself. Royal blood is just a way of translating.
In the old writing, it didn't mean only having royal relatives. Anybody can have those. It meant, oh, I don't know what you'd call it, something very special. And it seems to me that if you have it, you don't need to wonder whether you have it.
So, of course, said Taran, nettled by the girl's remarks, you've made up your mind that I'm not whatever it is.
I didn't mean to offend you, Ailanwy said quickly. For an assistant pig-keeper, I think you're quite remarkable. I even think you're the nicest person I've ever met in my life. It's just that I'm forbidden to let you have the sword, and that's that.
What will you do with it, then?
Keep it, naturally. I'm not going to drop it down a well, am I?
Taran snorted. You'll make a fine sight, a little girl carrying a sword.
I am not a little girl, said Ailanwy, tossing her hair in exasperation. Among my people in the olden days, the sword maidens did battle beside the men.
It's not the olden days now, Taran said. Instead of a sword, you should be carrying a doll. Ailanwy, with a squeal of vexation, raised a hand to slap at Taran when Flew de Flam returned.
Here now, said the bard. No squabbling. There's not a bit of use to it.
With a large key, he tightened the wooden peg holding the newly repaired harp string. Ailanwy turned her irritation on Fluda.
That inscription was a very important one. It didn't say anything about bewaring anyone's wrath. You didn't read it right at all. You're a fine bard, if you can't make out the writing on an enchanted sword.
Well, you see, the truth of the matter, said Fluda, clearing his throat and speaking with much hesitation, is this way. I'm not officially a bard.
I didn't know there were unofficial bards, Ailanwy remarked.
Oh, yes, indeed, said Fluda, at least in my case. I'm also a king.
A king? Taran said.
Sire.
He dropped to one knee.
None of that, none of that, said Fluda. I don't bother with it any more.
Where is your kingdom? Ailanwy asked.
Several days' journey east of Caer Dathil, said Fluda. It is a vast realm.
At this, Taran heard another jangling.
Drat the thing, said the bard. There go two more strings. As I was saying, yes, well, it is actually a rather small kingdom in the north. Very dull and dreary. So I gave it up. I'd always loved barding and wandering, and that's what I decided to do.
I thought bards had to study a great deal, Ailanwy said. A person can't just go and decide.
Yes, that was one of the problems, said the former king. I studied. I did quite well in the examinations.
A small string at the upper end of the harp broke with a high-pitched tinkle and curled up like an ivy tendril.
I did quite poorly, he went on, and the Council of Bards wouldn't admit me. Really, they want you to know so much these days, volumes and volumes of poetry, and chants and music and calculating the seasons, and history, and all kinds of alphabets you spell out on your fingers and secret signs. A man couldn't hope to cram it all into his skull.
The council were very nice to me, continued Fluda. Taliesin, the chief bard himself, presented me with his harp. He said it was exactly what I needed. I sometimes wonder if he was really doing me a favor. It's a very nice harp, but I have such trouble with the strings. I throw it away and get another, but it has a beautiful tone. I should never find one as good. If only the beastly strings.
They do seem to break frequently, Ailanwy began.
Yes, that's so, Fluda admitted a little sheepishly. I've noticed it usually happens when, well, I'm an emotional sort of fellow, and I do get carried away. I might, readjust the facts slightly, purely for dramatic effect, you understand.
If you'd just stop readjusting the facts quite as much, Ailanwy said, perhaps you wouldn't have that trouble with the harp.
Yes, I suppose, said the bard with a sigh. I try, but it's hard, very hard. As a king, you get into the habit. Sometimes I think I pass more time fixing strings than playing. But there it is. You can't have everything.
Where were you journeying when Akron captured you? Taran asked.
No place in particular, said Fluda.
That's one advantage. You don't have to hurry to get somewhere. You keep moving, and next thing you know, there you are. Unfortunately, in this case, it was Akron's dungeon. She didn't care for my playing. That woman has no ear for music, he added, shuddering. Sire, Taran said, I ask a boon. Please, said the former king, Fluda will do very well. A boon? Delighted. I haven't done any boon-granting since I gave up the throne. Fluda Flam and Ilanwe seated themselves on the turf, while Taran recounted his search for Henwen and what Gwydion had told him of the Horned King and the rising of the Cantrevs. Gurgi, having finished his meal, sidled over and squatted on a hillock to listen. There is no doubt in my mind, Taran went on, the Sons of Don must have news of the uprising before the Horned King strikes. If he triumphs, Aron will have Prydain by the throat. I have seen with my own eyes what that means. He felt ill at ease, speaking as if he himself were a war leader in a council hall, but soon the words began to come easier. Perhaps, he thought, because he was speaking for Gwydion. I see your plan, Fluda interrupted. You shall keep on looking for your pig, and you want me to warn the warriors of Don. Splendid! I shall start off immediately, and if the hosts of the Horned King overtake me— The bard slashed and thrust at the air. They shall know the valor of a Flam! Taran shook his head. No, I shall journey to Caer Dathil myself. I do not question your valor, he said to the bard, but the danger is too great. I ask no one else to face it in my stead. When do you intend to seek your pig? Asked Fluda. My own quest, said Taran, looking at the bard, must be given up. If it is possible, after the first task is done, I mean to return to it. Until then, I serve only Gwydion. It was I who cost him his life, and it is justice for me to do what I believe he would have done. As I grasp the situation, said the bard, I think you're taking too much blame on yourself. You had no way of knowing Gwydion wasn't in the dungeon. It changes nothing, Taran answered. I have made my decision. Fluda was about to protest, but the firmness of Taran's words silenced the bard. After a moment he asked, What is your boon, then? It is twofold, said Taran. First, tell me how I may reach Caer Dathil as quickly as possible. Second, I beg you to conduct this girl safely to her own people. Before Fluda could open his mouth, Ilanwe gave an indignant cry and leapt to her feet. Conducted? I shall be conducted where I please. I'm not going to be sent back, just so I can be sent somewhere else. And it will be another dreary place, you can be sure. No, I shall go to Caer Dathil, too. There is risk enough, Taran declared, without having to worry about a girl. Ilanwe put her hands on her hips. Her eyes flashed. I don't like being called a girl, and this girl, as if I didn't have a name at all. It's like having your head put in a sack. If you've made your decision, I've made my own. I don't see how you're going to stop me. If you, she hurried on, pointing at the bard, try to conduct me to my mean, stupid kinsmen, and they're hardly related to me in the first place, that harp will be in pieces around your ears. Fluda blinked and clutched his harp protectively, while Ilanwe went on. And if a certain assistant pig-keeper, I won't even mention his name, thinks otherwise, he'll be even more mistaken. Everyone started talking at once. "Stop it!" cried Taran at the top of his voice. "Very well," he said after the others grew quiet. "You," he said to Ilanwe, "could be tied up and set on Melengar. But," he added, raising his hand before the girl could interrupt, "that will not be done, not because of all the commotion you raised, but because I realize now it is best." The bard looked surprised. Taran continued, "There is greater safety in greater numbers. Whatever happens, there will be more chance for one of us to reach Caer Dathil. I believe we should all stay together."
"And faithful Gurgi, too," shouted Gurgi. "He will follow. Too many wicked enemies are smirking and lurking to jab him with pointy spears."
"If he agrees," Taran said, "Fluda shall act as guide. But I warn you," he added, glancing at Gurgi and Ilanwe, "nothing must hinder our task."
"Ordinarily," said Fluda, "I prefer to be in charge of this type of expedition myself.
But, he went on, as Taran was about to protest, since you are acting for Lord Gwydion, I accept your authority as I would accept his. He bowed low. A flam is yours to command.
Forward, then, the bard cried. And if we must give battle, so be it. Why, I've carved my way through walls of spearmen.
6 harp strings broke at once, and the others strained so tautly they looked on the verge of snapping. While Taran saddled Melengar, the bard set ruefully to work, repairing his harp. Chapter 11 Flight Through the Hills. At first, Taran offered to let Ailanwy ride Melengar, but the girl refused.
"I can walk as well as any of you," she cried, so angrily that Taran made no more of it.
He had learned to be wary of the girl's sharp tongue. It was agreed that the white mare would carry the weapons taken from Spiral Castle, except the sword Durnwin, of which Ailanwy had appointed herself guardian. Scratching in the dirt with his dagger point, Fruta Flam showed Taran the path he intended to follow.
"The hosts of the Horned King will surely stay in the Valley of Istrad. It's the easiest way for an army on the march.
Spiral Castle was here," he added, with an angry jab to mark the spot, "west of the River Istrad. Now the shortest road would be straight north over these hills." "That is the one we must take," said Taran, trying hard to make sense of Fluda's criss-crossing lines.
"Wouldn't recommend it, my friend. We should be passing a little too near Anuvin. Aron's strongholds are close to Spiral Castle, and I suggest we keep clear of them. No, what I believe we should do is this. Stay on the high ground of the western bank of the Istrad. We can go quite directly, since we needn't follow the valley itself. That way, we can avoid both Anuvin and the Horned King. The four of us can move faster than heavily armed warriors. We shall come out well ahead of them, not too far from Caer Dathil. From there, we make a dash for it, and our task is done."
Fluda straightened up, beaming with satisfaction.
"There you have it," he said, wiping the dirt from his dagger. "A brilliant strategy. My own war leader couldn't have arranged it better."
"Yes," said Taran, his head still muddled with the bard's talk of high ground and western banks. "That sounds very reasonable." They descended to a broad, sun-swept meadow. The morning had turned bright and warm. Dew still clung to bending blades of grass. At the head of the travellers strode Fluda, stepping out briskly on his long, spindly shanks. The harp jogged on his back. His shabby cloak was rolled over his shoulder. Ailanwy, hair dishevelled by the breeze, the great black sword slung behind her, followed next, with Gergi immediately after. So many new leaves and twigs had stuck in Gergi's hair that he had begun to look like a walking beaver dam. He loped along, swinging his arms, shaking his head from side to side, moaning and muttering. Holding Melengar's bridle, Taran marched last in line. Except for the weapons lashed to the horse's saddle, these travellers might have been on a spring ramble. Ailanwy chattered gaily. Now and then Fluda burst into a snatch of song. Taran alone was uneasy. To him, the bright morning felt deceptively gentle. The golden trees seemed to cover dark shadows. He shuddered, even in the warmth. His heart was troubled, too, as he watched his companions. In Caer Dalban, he had dreamed of being a hero, but dreaming, he had come to learn, was easy. And at Caer Dalban, no lives depended on his judgment. He longed for Gwydion's strength and guidance. His own strength, he feared, was not equal to his task. He turned once for a last look in the direction of Spiral Castle, Gwydion's burial mound. Over the hill crest, stark against the clouds, rose 2 figures on horseback. Taran shouted and gestured for his companions to take cover in the woods. Melengar galloped forward. In another moment, they were all crouching in a thicket. The horsemen followed along the crest, too far away for Taran to see their faces clearly. But from their rigid postures, he could guess at the livid features and dull eyes of the Cauldronborn.
"How long have they been behind us?" asked Fluda. "Have they seen us?"
Taran looked cautiously through the screen of leaves. He pointed toward the slope.
"There is your answer," he said.
From the crest, the pale cauldron warriors had turned their horses toward the meadow and were steadily picking their way down the hill.
"Hurry," ordered Taran. "We must outrun them."
The group did not return to the meadow, but struck out across the woods. The appearance of the cauldron-born now forced them to abandon the path Fluda had chosen, but the bard hoped they might throw the warriors off the track and circle back again to higher ground. Staying close to one another, they moved at a dog trot, not daring to stop even for water. The forest offered a measure of protection from the sun, but after a time the pace began to tell on them. Only Gergi did not seem fatigued or uncomfortable. He loped steadily along, and the swarms of midges and stinging insects could not penetrate his matted hair. Ailanwy, who proudly insisted she enjoyed running, clung to Melengar's stirrup. Taran could not be sure how close the warriors were. He knew the cauldron-born would hardly fail to track them, by sound if nothing else, for they no longer attempted to move silently. Speed was their only hope, and long after nightfall they pressed on. It had become a blind race into darkness, under a moon drowned in heavy clouds. Invisible branches grasped at them or slashed their faces. Ailanwy stumbled once, and Taran pulled her to her feet. The girl faltered again. Her head drooped. Taran unstrapped the weapons on Melengar's saddle, shared out the burden with Fluda and Gergi, and hoisted the protesting Ailanwy to Melengar's back. She slumped forward, her cheek pressed against the horse's golden mane. All night they struggled through the forest, which grew denser the closer they approached the Estrad Valley. By the time the first hesitating light of day appeared, even Gergi had begun to stumble with fatigue, and could barely put one hairy foot in front of the other. Ailanwy had fallen into a slumber so deep that Taran feared she was ill. Her hair lay bedraggled and damp upon her forehead. Her face was pallid. With the bard's help, Taran lifted her from the saddle and propped her against a mossy bank. When he ventured to unbuckle the cumbersome sword, Ailanwy opened one eye, made an irritated face, and pulled the blade away from him, with more determination than he had expected.
"You never understand things the first time," Ailanwy murmured, her grip firm on the weapon, "but I imagine assistant pig-keepers are all alike. I told you before you're not to have it, and now I'll tell you for a second time. Or is it the third, or fourth? I must have lost count."
So saying, she wrapped her arms around the scabbard and dropped back to sleep. "We must rest here," Taran said to the bard, "if only a little while." "At the moment," groaned Fluda, who had stretched out full length with his toes and nose pointing straight into the air, "I don't care who catches me. I'd welcome Aron himself and ask whether he had any breakfast with him."
"The cauldron-born might have lost track of us during the night," Taran said hopefully, but without great conviction. "I wish I knew how far we've left them behind, if we've left them behind at all."
Gergi brightened a little.
"Clever Gergi will know," he cried, "with seekings and peekings."
In another moment, Gergi was halfway up a tall pine. He clambered easily to the top and perched there like an enormous crow, scanning the land in the direction they had traveled. Taran, meanwhile, opened the saddlebags. So little food remained that it was hardly worth dividing. He and Fluda agreed to give Ailanwy the last of the provisions. Gergi had scented food even at the top of the pine tree, and he came scuttling down, snuffling eagerly at the prospect of his crunchings and munchings.
"Stop thinking about eating for a moment," Taran cried. "What did you see?"
"Two warriors afar. But Gergi sees them. Yes, yes, they are riding full of wickedness and fierceness. But there is time for a small crunching," Gergi pleaded. "Oh, very small for clever, valiant Gergi."
"There are no more crunchings," said Taran. "If the cauldron-born are still on our heels, you had better worry less about food and more about your own skin."
"But Gergi will find munchings very quickly. Oh, yes, he is so wise to get them, to comfort the bellies of great noble lords. But they will forget poor Gergi, and not even give him snips and snaps for his eatings."
After a hurried discussion with Fluda, who looked as ravenous as Gergi, Taran agreed they might take a little time to search for berries and edible roots.
"Quite right,"
said the bard. "Better eat what we can get now, while the cauldron-born give us a chance to do it. I shall help you. I know all about foraging in the woods. Do it constantly." The harp tensed, and one string showed signs of giving way. "No," he added quickly. "I had better stay with Alanwi. The truth is, I can't tell a mushroom from a toadstool. I wish I could. It would make the life of a wandering bard considerably more filling." With cloaks in which to carry back whatever they might find, Taran and Gergi set off. At a small stream, Taran halted to fill Gwydion's leather water flask. Gergi, sniffing hungrily, ran ahead and disappeared into a stand of rowans. Near the bank of the stream, Taran discovered mushrooms and gathered them hurriedly. Bent on his own search, he paid little heed to Gergi until he suddenly heard anguished yelps from behind the trees. Clutching his precious mushrooms, Taran hastened to see what had happened, and came upon Gergi lying in the middle of the grove, writhing and whimpering, a honeycomb beside him. At first, Taran thought Gergi had got himself stung by bees. Then he saw the creature was in more serious trouble. While Gergi had climbed for the honey, a dead branch had snapped under his weight. His twisted leg was pinned to the ground with a heavy wood on top of it. Taran heaved the branch away. The panting Gergi shook his head.
"Poor Gergi's leg is broken," he moaned. "There will be no more amblings and ramblings for him now."
Taran bent and examined the injury. The leg was not broken, though badly torn and swelling rapidly.
"Now Gergi's head must be chopped off," the creature moaned. "Do it, great lord, do it quickly. Gergi will squeeze up his eyes so as not to see hurtful slashings."
Taran looked closely at Gergi. The creature was in earnest. His eyes pleaded with Taran.
"Yes, yes," cried Gergi. "Now, before silent warriors arrive, Gergi is better dead at your sword than in their hands. Gergi cannot walk. All will be killed with fearful smitings and bitings. It is better—"
"No," said Taran. "You won't be left in the woods, and you won't have your head chopped off, by me or anyone else." For a moment Taran almost regretted his words. The poor creature was right, he knew. The injury would slow their pace. And Gergi, like all of them, would be better off dead than in Aron's grasp. Still, Taran could not bring himself to draw his sword. "You and Ilan, we can ride Melengar," Taran said, lifting Gergi to his feet and putting one of the creature's hairy arms about his shoulder. "Come on now, one step at a time." Taran was exhausted when they reached Ilanwi and the bard. The girl had recovered noticeably and was chattering even faster than before. While Gergi lay silently on the grass, Taran divided the honeycomb. The portions were pitifully small. Fluda called Taran aside. "Your hairy friend is going to make things difficult," he said quietly. "If Melengar carries two riders, I don't know how much longer she can keep up."
"That is true," said Taran, "yet I see nothing else we can do. Would you abandon him? Would you have cut off his head?"
"Absolutely," cried the bard, "in a flash. A flam never hesitates. Fortunes of war and all that. Oh, drat and blast! There goes another string, a thick one, too."
When Taran went back to rearrange the weapons they would now be obliged to bear, he was surprised to find a large oak leaf on the ground before his cloak. On the leaf lay Gergi's tiny portion of honeycomb.
"For great lord," murmured Gergi. "Gergi is not hungry for crunchings and munchings today."
Taran looked at the eager face of Gergi. For the first time, they smiled at one another. "Your gift is generous," Taran said softly, "but you travel as one of us, and you will need all your strength. Keep your share. It is yours by right, and you have more than earned it." He put his hand gently on Gergi's shoulder. The wet wolfhound odor did not seem as objectionable as before. Chapter 12. The Wolves. For a time during the day, Taran believed they had at last outdistanced the cauldron-born. But, late that afternoon, The warriors reappeared from behind a distant fringe of trees. Against the westering sun, the long shadows of the horsemen reached across the hill slope toward the flatlands where the small troop struggled onward. "We must stand against them sooner or later," Taran said, wiping his forehead. "Let it be now. There can be no victory over the Cauldronborn, but with luck, we can hold them off a little while. If Ilanwe and Gergi can escape, there is still a chance." Gergi, draped over Melengar's saddle, immediately set up a great outcry.
"No, no! Faithful Gergi stays with the mighty lord who spared his poor tender head. Happy, grateful Gergi will fight, too, with slashings and gashings."
"We appreciate your sentiments," said Fluda, "but with that leg of yours, you're hardly up to slashing or gashing or anything at all."
"I'm not going to run either," Ilanwe put in. "I'm tired of running and having my face scratched and my robe torn, all on account of those stupid warriors."
She jumped lightly from the saddle and snatched a bow and a handful of arrows from Taran's pack.
"Ilanwe, stop!" Taran cried. "These are deathless men. They cannot be killed."
Although encumbered by the long sword hanging from her shoulder, Ilanwe ran faster than Taran. By the time he caught up with her, she had climbed a hillock and was stringing the bow. The Cauldronborn galloped across the plain. The sun glinted on their drawn swords. Taran seized the girl by the waist and tried to pull her away. He received a sharp kick in the shins.
"Must you always interfere with everything?" Ilanwe asked indignantly.
Before Taran could reach for her again, she held an arrow toward the sun and murmured a strange phrase. She knocked the arrow and loosed it in the direction of the Cauldronborn. The shaft arched upward and almost disappeared against the bright rays. Open-mouthed, Taran watched while the shaft began its descent. As the arrow plummeted to earth, long, silvery streamers sprang from its feathers. In an instant, a huge spiderweb glittered in the air and drifted slowly toward the horsemen. Fluda, who had run up just then, stopped in amazement.
"Great Belin!" he exclaimed. "What's that?
It looks like decorations for a feast."
The web slowly settled over the Cauldronborn, but the pallid warriors paid it no heed. They spurred their mounts onward. The strands of the web broke and melted away. Ilanwe clapped a hand to her mouth.
"It didn't work," she cried almost in tears. "The way Aklan does it, she makes it into a big sticky rope. Oh, it's all gone wrong. I tried to listen behind the door when she was practicing, but I've missed something important."
She stamped her foot and turned away.
"Take her from here," Taran called to the bard. He unsheathed his sword and faced the Cauldronborn. Within moments they would be upon him.
But even as he braced for their onslaught, he saw the horsemen falter. The Cauldronborn reined up suddenly, then, without a gesture, turned their horses and rode silently back toward the hills.
"It worked! It worked after all!" cried the astonished Fluda.
Ilanwe shook her head.
"No," she said with discouragement. "Something turned them away, but I'm afraid it wasn't my spell."
She unstrung the bow and picked up the arrow she had dropped. "I think I know what it was," Taran said. "They are returning to Arun. Gwydion told me they could not stay long from Anuvin. Their power must have been waning ever since we left Spiral Castle, and they reached the limit of their strength right here."
"I hope they don't have enough to get back to Anuvin," Ilanwe said. "I hope they fall into pieces or shrivel up like bats."
"I doubt that they will," Taran said, watching the horsemen slowly disappear over the ridge. "They must know how long they can stay and how far they can go, and still return to their master." He gave Ilanwe an admiring glance. "It doesn't matter. They're gone. And that was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Gwydion had a mesh of grass that burst into flame, but I've never met anyone else who could make a web like that." Ilanwe looked at him in surprise. Her cheeks blushed brighter than the sunset.
"Why, Taran of Caer Dalbyn," she said. "I think that's the first polite thing you've said to me."
Then suddenly Ilanwe tossed her head and sniffed.
"Of course, I should have known. It was the spider web. You were more interested in that. You didn't care whether I was in danger."
She strode haughtily back to Gergi and Melengar.
"But that's not true," Taran called. "I was—"
By then Ilanwe was out of earshot. Crestfallen, Taran followed her.
"I can't make sense out of that girl," he said to the bard. "Can you?"
"Never mind," Fluda said. "We aren't really expected to." That night, they continued to take turns at standing guard, though much of their fear had lifted since the Cauldronborn had vanished. Taran's was the last watch before dawn, and he was awake well before Ilanwiz had ended. "You had better sleep," Taran told her. "I'll finish the watch for you."
"I'm perfectly able to do my share," said Ilanwi,
who had not stopped being irritated at him since the afternoon. Taran knew better than to insist. He picked up his bow and quiver arrows, stood near the dark trunk of an oak, and looked out across the moon-silvered meadow. Nearby, Fluda snored heartily. Gergi, whose leg had shown no improvement, stirred restlessly and whimpered in his sleep. "You know," Taran began with embarrassed hesitation, "that spiderweb..."
"I don't want to hear any more about it," retorted Ilanwi.
"No, what I meant was, I really was worried about you, but the web surprised me so much I forgot to mention it. It was courageous of you to stand up against the Cauldron Warriors. I just wanted to tell you that."
"You took long enough getting around to it," said Ilanwi,
a tone of satisfaction in her voice.
"But I imagine assistant pig keepers tend to be slower than what you might expect. It probably comes from the kind of work they do. Don't misunderstand. I think it's awfully important. Only it's the sort of thing you don't often need to be quick about."
"At first," Taran went on, "I thought I would be able to reach Caer Dathil by myself. I see now that I wouldn't have got even this far without help. It is a good destiny that brings me such brave companions."
"There, you've done it again," Ilanwi
cried so heatedly that Fluda choked on one of his snores.
"That's all you care about, someone to help you carry spears and swords and what all. It could be anybody, and you'd be just as pleased. Taran of Caer Dalban, I'm not speaking to you any more."
"At home," Taran said to himself. Ilanwi had already pulled a cloak over her head and was feigning sleep. "Nothing ever happened. Now everything happens. But somehow I can never seem to make it come out right." With a sigh, he held his bow ready and began his turn at guard. Daylight was long in coming. In the morning, Taran saw Gergi's leg was much worse, and he left the campsite to search the woods for healing plants, glad that Karl had taught him the properties of herbs. He made a poultice and set it on Gergi's wound. Fluda, meanwhile, had begun drawing new maps with his dagger. The Cauldron Warriors, explained the bard, had forced the companions too deeply into the Estrad Valley. Returning to their original path would cost them at least 2 days of hard travel.
"Since we're this far," Fluda went on, "we might just as well cross Estrad and follow along the hills, staying out of sight of the Horned King. We'll be only a few days from Caer Dathil, and if we keep a good pace, we should reach it just in time."
Taran agreed to the new plan. It would, he realized, be more difficult. But he judged Melengar could still carry the unfortunate Gergi, as long as the companions shared the burden of the weapons. Ilanwi, having forgotten she was not speaking to Taran, again insisted on walking. A day's march brought them to the banks of the Estrad. Taran stole cautiously ahead. Looking down the broad valley, he saw a moving dust cloud. When he hurried back and reported this to Fluda, the bard clapped him on the shoulder.
"We're ahead of them," he said. "That is excellent news. I was afraid they'd be much closer to us, and we'd have to wait for nightfall to cross Estrad. We've saved half a day. Hurry now, and we'll be into the foothills of Eagle Mountains before sundown."
With his precious harp held above his head, Fluda plunged into the river, and the others followed. Here the Estrad ran shallow, scarcely above Ilanwi's waist, and the companions forded it with little difficulty. Nevertheless, they emerged cold and dripping, and the setting sun neither dried nor warmed them. Leaving the Estrad behind, the companions climbed slopes steeper and rockier than any they had travelled before. Perhaps it was only his imagination, but the air of the land around Spiral Castle had seemed, to Taran, heavy and oppressive. Approaching the Eagle Mountains, Taran felt his burden lighten as he inhaled the dry, spicy scent of pine. He had planned to continue the march throughout most of the night, but Gergi's condition had worsened, obliging Taran to call a halt. Despite the herbs, Gergi's leg was badly inflamed, and he shivered with fever. He looked thin and sad. The suggestion of crunchings and munchings could not rouse him. Even Melengar showed concern. As Gergi lay with his eyes half closed, his parched lips tight against his teeth, the white mare nuzzled him delicately, whinnying and blowing out her breath anxiously, as if attempting to comfort him as best she could. Taran risked lighting a small fire. He and Fluda stretched Gergi out beside it. While Alanwi held up the suffering creature's head and gave him a drink from the leather flask, Taran and the bard moved a little away and spoke quietly between themselves. "I have done all I know," Taran said. "If there is anything else, it lies beyond my skill." He shook his head sorrowfully. "He has failed badly today, and there is so little of him left, I believe I could pick him up with one hand." "Caer Dathil is not far away," said Fluda, "but our friend, I fear, may not live to see it." That night, wolves howled in the darkness beyond the fire. All next day, the wolves followed them. Sometimes silently, sometimes barking as if in signal to one another, they remained always out of bowshot, but Taran caught sight of the lean, grey shapes flickering in and out of the scrubby trees. "As long as they don't come any closer," he said to the bard, "we needn't worry about them." "Oh, they won't attack us," Fluda answered. "Not now, at any rate. They can be infuriatingly patient if they know someone's wounded." He turned an anxious glance toward Gergi. "For them, it's just a matter of waiting."
"Well, I must say, you're a cheerful one," remarked Alanwi. "You sound as if all we had to look forward to was being gobbled up."
"If they attack, we shall stand them off," Taran said quietly. "Gergi was willing to give up his life for us. I can do no less for him. Above all, we must not lose heart so close to the end of our journey."
"A flam never loses heart," cried the bard. "Come wolves, or what have you?"
Nevertheless, uneasiness settled over the companions as the grey shapes continued trailing them, and Melengar, docile and obedient until now, turned skittish. The golden-maned horse tossed her head and rolled her eyes at every attempt to lead her. To make matters worse, Fluda declared their progress through the hills was too slow.
"If we go any farther east," said the bard, "we'll run into some really high mountains. The condition we're in, we couldn't possibly climb them, but here, we're practically walled in."
"Every path has led us round about. The cliffs there," he went on, pointing toward the towering mass of rock to his left, "are too rugged to get over. I had thought we'd find a pass before now. Well, that's the way of it. We can only keep on bearing north as much as possible."
"The wolves didn't seem to have any trouble finding their way," said Alanwi.
"My dear girl," answered the bard, with some indignation, "if I were able to run on four legs and sniff my dinner a mile away, I doubt I'd have any difficulties either."
Alanwi giggled.
"I'd love to see you try," she said.
"We do have someone who can run on four legs," Taran said suddenly. "Melengar! If anyone can find their way to Caer Dathil, she can."
The bard snapped his fingers.
"That's it," he cried. "Every horse knows its way home. It's worth trying, and we can't be worse off than we are now."
"For an assistant pit keeper," said Alanwi to Taran, "you do come up with some interesting ideas now and then."
When the companions started off again, Taran dropped the bridle and gave Melengar her head. With the half-conscious Gergi bound to her saddle, the white horse trotted swiftly ahead at a determined gait. By mid-afternoon, Melengar discovered one pass which, Fluda admitted, he himself would have overlooked. As the day wore on, Melengar led them swiftly through rocky defiles to high ridges. It was all the companions could do to keep up with her. When she cantered into a long ravine, Taran lost sight of her for a moment and hurried forward in time to glimpse the mare as she turned sharply around an outcropping of white stone. Calling the bard and Ailanwi to follow quickly, Taran ran ahead. He stopped suddenly. To his left, on a high shelf of rock, crouched an enormous wolf, with golden eyes and lolling red tongue. Before Taran could draw his sword,
the lean animal sprang. Chapter 13. The Hidden Valley. The impact of the heavy furry body caught Taran full in the chest and sent him tumbling. As he fell, he caught a glimpse